Hello, I'm Geeta Nadkarni. This is number 0493, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0493. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, NASA expert Rod Pyle is the author of several books, and he's back on the show. His latest is Space 2.0, which is a bit of a forward-looking departure for him.
Most of my books take about a year to do, mainly because I'm telling histories. It's something I've done enough that I'm familiar with the territory, and then I just got to do the research for those individual tales, but at least I know the overview really well. This was an entirely new thing because it's forward-looking, it's a little bit of policy, it's a lot of conjecture about where we're going to be in the next 10 to 20 years, which is constantly evolving.
Web developer Michael Perez on his new web series called Travelpreneurs, Breaking the 9-to-5. He's sharing his lifestyle with others.
I travel around the U.S. and Canada working, and I meet all sorts of amazing folks on the way. And throughout this process, I've learned kind of like how to hack the system, get the right credit cards, do things correctly, travel effectively, find the cheapest flights, and make sure that my work lifestyle has no geographical constraints. I get to travel freely and work in the cloud.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and Book Banter powers up the Wayback Machine to the summer of 1974. And how a single game of Reach for the Top affected a single province in Joan Sullivan's book Game. So get ready to test your knowledge and power of quick recall coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0493, was Geeta Nadkarni, a former media personality turned business coach who's helping people monetize their purpose. She's also a spectacularly wonderful human being. I used to work with her many years ago back in the day. Fine, fine person indeed. By the way, she helps entrepreneurs position themselves at a premium and then uses uncommon PR techniques to influence buyers around the world. And you can reach her via Instagram. Her Instagram handle is @lifewithgeeta, and Geeta is spelled G-E-E-T-A, so that's @lifewithgeeta, and her website is babygotbooked.com. And of course, you can find the links I just mentioned by going to the Stuff File website for the show of this number, which you just heard Geeta mention, which proves how this all comes around full circle. Yes. Thank you very much, Geeta, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? I just want to start off by mentioning that back on Sunday, January 20th, I had the pleasure to co-host a two-hour live worldwide webcast with science writer Andrew Vazekas, the night sky guy, that celebrated the rare super blood wolf moon that was the result of the lunar eclipse that took place. Now, if you weren't able to see the live special, you can always watch it on YouTube. I have put a link in to the YouTube edition, which you can find on our website at thestufffile.com on the page for this week's show. Now, whether you were watching our show live or if you were lucky enough to see the moon for yourself, if you had clear skies, there was no danger in seeing the celestial event. Although the eclipse was so captivating to some sky watchers on Florida's Ponte Verde Beach that they didn't notice when the tide rolled in and waterlogged their Honda CRV. The St. Johns County Sheriff's Office said the occupants were able to get out of the car and move to safety, although the vehicle itself wasn't recovered until the next day. A photo showed water up to the windshield on the front end of the car. Okay, I thought the moon was fascinating too, But how do you spend that much time staring at something without noticing that your car is slowly sinking below sea level? Wow, that's dedication to stargazing, isn't it? Meanwhile, in West Palm Beach, Florida, and you'll notice both of these stories come from Florida, I'm not casting any aspersions, I'm just merely stating fact. Two unnamed 24-year-olds chose to view the eclipse by lying prone in the middle of a dark road near the Epoxy Wilderness Trail. You know where this is going, don't you? Yeah. Which would have worked out fine for them, except that at around 11:30 p.m., a West Palm Beach police officer patrolling the area ran over the pair. Fortunately, he was cruising at just 5 miles per hour, and the human speed bumps sustained only non-life-threatening injuries. The officer was put on paid administrative leave while the incident was investigated. Okay, unless you have chronic back pain or neck problems, do you really need to lie down to see the moon? And if that's the case, do you need to do it on the road? I mean, that's just not lunar. That's lunacy. A woman was charged with driving under the influence after consuming whipped cream. Police said that 28-year-old Anna Thomas of Franklin, Tennessee, used cans of aerosol whipped cream to get high. She was charged with driving under the influence after crashing her car. When police arrived, Thomas was disoriented. Officers found 13 cans of whipped cream scattered inside the vehicle. Almost all of the bottles were empty. No pie was discovered. You know, it's because of people like Anna that they'll have to create new laws, which means when someone has a bake-off, they won't be able to buy whipped cream in bulk. That'll be a sad day. Meanwhile, police say a Connecticut woman charged with driving under the influence was drunk on vanilla extract, which contains a significant amount of alcohol. New Canaan police found 50-year-old Stephanie Warner Grice sitting in a car at an intersection with her eyes closed at about 4:45 p.m. on Wednesday. Officers say they found several bottles of pure vanilla extract inside her car. They say they detected an odor of vanilla on her breath, her speech was slurred, and she was unable to answer basic questions. Police say she was arrested after failing a field sobriety test. You know, it's because of people like Stephanie that they'll have to create new laws, which means when someone has a bake-off, they won't be able to buy pure vanilla extract in bulk. That will be a sad day. And by the way, I bake with pure vanilla myself. Do you know how expensive that is? And she had several bottles of the stuff. There are much cheaper ways for her to get her buzz on. Talk about champagne tastes. Wow. And finally, in this section of Stuffall News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuffall program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Cody Lutz thinks the tire tracks to his Petersburg, Kentucky yard tell the story. Someone tried to drive through his giant snowman, but the determination didn't go as the driver planned. Lutz, his fiancée, and her sister had built the 9-foot snowman, and they'd built the base around a tree stump, covering it within a giant snowball. The driver evidently discovered the stump the hard way. That, Lutz said, was instant karma. Yes, Cody, it was instant karma. And in this case, you can spell karma with either a K or a C. Seriously. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuffall program, shall we? NASA expert Rod Pyle is back on with us. He's been very, very busy of late. This year, he will have 7 books on the shelves, 4 brand new ones and 3 reprints. His newest title, which is just coming out, is called Space 2.0, How Private Spaceflight, a Resurgent NASA, and International Partners are Creating a New Space Age. He's also the editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine, which is published by the National Space Society. And Rod joins us once again on the line from California via Skype. Hi, Rod.
Hi, how are you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us once again.
So my pleasure. And I want to hire you from now on to be the guy that reads that subtitle, because that's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, your book is a mouthful.
Yeah, well, authors don't get to select the subtitles. We're told by the marketing departments what to have there. But I think it's a good choice because it really does cover what the book's about. So when people ask, I could say, well, look at the cover.
Okay, well then, Rod, thank you for being on the program.
Okay, bye.
So tell us about the book Space 2.0.
So this is something that most of my books take about a year to do, mainly because I'm telling histories. It's something I've done enough that I'm familiar with the territory, and then I just got to do the research for those individual tales, but at least I know the overview really well. This was an entirely new thing because it's forward-looking, it's a little bit of policy, it's a lot of conjecture about where we're going to be in the next 10 to 20 years, which is constantly evolving. So about 5 years ago, I started pushing this as a proposal, and it went to a number of publishers, and yeah, they wanted to do it, but they were concerned about the risk and so forth. So I finally thought, hey, I'm going to go talk to the National Space Society. I'm engaged with them anyway. And I said, look, this is the agenda of this book is exactly what you care about. It's, you know, lowering launch costs, looking ahead to developing infrastructure in space, looking ahead to settling space with both robots and human beings. Can we work on this together? And not to oversimplify the answer, but a couple of the people there that do get things done said yes. So we went out and raised some money. That underwrote the book. Got a wonderful publisher, Ben Bellow, who's been an incredible pleasure to work with. And 5 years later, here we are. The one thing that I didn't anticipate, I knew it was going to be a challenge, and I knew I had to interview between 30 and 40 people in major national space programs, the private sector like SpaceX and Blue Origin and NASA and so forth. What I didn't anticipate is because it's a print book and there's this long editorial process that I'd be calling my editor every week or two saying, we got to change something. What do you mean? Well, Elon Musk changed the name of his rocket again, or this happened, or that shifted, or this national policy changed. So it's an incredible moving target, which if you're writing a book and editing is frustrating. On the other hand, it just shows how dynamic and rapidly evolving this is. And that's really exciting.
Well, speaking about the excitement factor, I mean, when we were growing up, there was the excitement of man first attempting to go to the moon. There was, you go from Mercury to Apollo, and then you had the space shuttle, and there was some excitement about going into space. There had been a bit of a lull where, you know, there's not much happening. The U.S. is not sending a man into flight anymore. We have to hitch a ride on Russia's Uber. And as a result, it doesn't seem as exciting or sexy as it was when we were growing up. But having the opportunity to write this book and look into the future, with the knowledge you have of what has taken place, does it bring a spark of that excitement again?
Well, it does. It doesn't hurt that right towards the end of the process, Elon Musk managed to get the Falcon Heavy off, and we were all keeping our eye on that. It was a big roll of the dice. It was years late. He had thought it was going to be as simple as basically strapping together three Falcon 9s and lighting a match under it, but it didn't work out that way, and they had to basically redesign the whole thing. But this is really, there's been a lot of turning points, you know, small pivots in this private space sector development. But this is huge because it's a rocket that's got between two and three times the capacity of the previous current heavyweight, which is the Delta IV Heavy that United Launch Alliance puts together. But it's at between a quarter and a fifth the price of that rocket. So this is a huge market shift that's practically exponential. And seeing that thing work, you know, test flights don't usually work out that well. The launch wasn't even late. It took them, 3 months to get the Delta Heavy off that just launched, that NROL flight that just launched out of Vandenberg, to the point that somebody wrote in on one of the Facebook pages, has it rusted to the pad yet? Which I thought was a little snarky, but it was kind of cute. You know, usually these, and that's a very mature rocket. So for Musk to get that off at the first try in the first afternoon is breathtaking. Watching those two side boosters fly back and land themselves, it looked just like the computer graphic he had done. Just, you know, I know this stuff. I'm used to it. It blew my mind. I had to stay home and watch it on TV because I knew if I went to one of these viewing parties that we all got invited to, I was going to be the old man sobbing in the corner and people going to say, hey, what's wrong with Grandpa over there, you know? So, yeah, I'm going a little far afield here, but yes, I'm very excited. I think there's a lot of promise. But going back to your question, though, you know, it was an incredible time to be alive when we were in the 60s and 70s, because these unbelievable missions of exploration were thundering off to the moon as frequently as every couple of months. And this is something that young people have never seen. They've seen the shuttle launch, this kind of slow, gradual schedule that never really reached the potential they had hoped. And they've seen the space station be assembled. But somehow this is all less immediate and more abstract than what we experienced. I mean, there's this magnificent $175 billion machine going over our heads every 90 minutes, biggest machine ever assembled, huge structure, does incredible work, but it's kind of the same thing over and over again in terms of the news cycle. So part of this is NASA telling its story better, which isn't really part of their charter, and people like me trying to tell their story in a more engaging way. And that's really a challenge. So I'd say, you know, it's a combination of both those things. But the pace is definitely picking up. And the next 5 years are just going to be jaw-dropping. And that's not just the U.S. That's in China and India and Europe and Russia and the other space powers, too.
In the last little while, when I've talked to you or Andrew Vazakis, we've often brought up some of the people like Elon Musk and other private companies that are doing a lot as far as space is concerned. But in your book, Space 2.0, one of the parts of the subtitle is a resurgent NASA. So what is happening at NASA?
Well, they have managed to not only keep their budget, but get it upped a little bit. So it's 19 point something billion dollars a year now, which sounds like a lot, but it goes pretty quickly. And one of the things I mentioned in the book is this weird perception that Americans have about NASA. So Pew and Gallup and these other groups do polls every 5 or 10 years. And the last one is a few years back. But a lot of people, something like 40% of Americans, thought that NASA's budget was like a quarter of the federal budget, which is jaw-dropping to me. It's half of 1%. During the Apollo program, when NASA was doing much less, all they were doing then was flying either Mercury, Gemini, or Apollo and a few unmanned missions to a couple of target planets with 5% of the federal budget. Now they've got a tenth of that, and they're operating at this point probably 15 planetary missions, both new and old, dozens and dozens of Earth orbital missions, and the space station, and building SLS and Orion. So they're doing a lot more with a whole lot less. So that's a major factor, you know, and it's something that I think people miss. And I kind of strayed from your question. Put me back on track here.
And that is, what is the resurgence? What are you looking forward to in the future from NASA?
Well, what I'm really looking forward to, I mean, we've got the SLS, which it's the Space Launch System. Many in my racket refer to as the Senate Launch System, sort of tongue-in-cheek, and the Orion capsule, which is built to be essentially lunar and Mars-rated, perhaps, ultimately. But the exciting part, I think, where the real magic is going to happen is in NASA finding its best balance, the sweet spot between what they can do best and what private industry can do best. And private industry, as you know, for 60 years, in terms of spaceflight, has been contractors on a cost-plus basis, building these highly inflated, expensive systems. And when NASA had lots of money, you could afford that. Now that they don't have the kind of money they used to in relative terms, they haven't been able to do all that much. And that's what's really slowed things down, especially the human spaceflight side. We've still done wonderful things in the robotic side. But with SpaceX and Blue Origin coming along, with these billionaires saying, yeah, I want to build a rocket. I'm going to build it my way, and hopefully NASA will come in and buy rides on it. This has really turned the whole thing upside down. It's driving the established contractors nuts, and in some cases out of business, or nearly so. And what we're going to find, I think, in a couple more years is there's still going to be some wrinkles to iron out, but between Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos' company, and Musk's SpaceX, we're seeing this gross reduction in launch costs, this increase in efficiency. Even the internal NASA studies say that SpaceX's costs are between a half and a fifth of, in some cases, a tenth of what it cost them to do things. So we're going to, I think, find that private industry will be doing a lot of the heavy lifting from Earth to orbit. Private industry, probably in concert with NASA, will be setting up this infrastructure I keep talking about between Earth orbit and the moon and back, where you can start mining these resources out of lunar water ice and so forth, so you don't have to spend all this money launching things. And then NASA could do what they do best, which is selecting important missions for both a scientific and a philosophical and a human and an exploration aspects, and moving beyond Earth orbit to really start working, being the first people back to the moon, hopefully, and getting onto Mars, either as a single entity or perhaps in concert with an international consortium, hopefully including the Chinese, if we can make that work.
Gee, you're so good at explaining all this, which is probably why your book is going to be fascinating when it does come out. I got to tell
you. Well, I hope so. Yeah, we'll see. I'll get you a copy.
The book is Space 2.0, How Private Space Flight, a Resurgent NASA, and International Partners Are Creating a New Space Age. Rod, I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
NASA expert Rod Pyle. His latest book is Space 2.0, How Private Space Flight, a Resurgent NASA, and International Partners Are Creating a New Space Age. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the page for this show, which is show number 0493, and you'll find links to Rod's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll chat with serial tech entrepreneur Michael Perez. Plus, Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com, and whichever platform you listen to the program on, please, please feel free to leave a review on the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Okay, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? Oh, it's time for the Darwin File.
I am the Grim Reaper. I am death.
There are friends and there are friends. Then there are friends like Elijah Ray Lambert, who will willingly shoot you in the chest. Lambert was friends with the late Miguel Martinez of Citrus Heights, California. Somewhere, Miguel got hold of a bulletproof vest and decided he wanted to test it to see if it would really stop a bullet. But why put it on a mannequin or tie it to a tree when you can put it on yourself, right? As long as you have a friend like Lambert who is willing to pull the trigger for you. Deputies arrested Lambert for the shooting, but the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department has characterized the incident as an unintentional killing. Martinez's brother reported that the bullet had actually penetrated the top of his vest, indicating that not only does Lambert have bad judgment, he's also a lousy shot. The pair were with 2 other friends, the police said. The group initially reported the shooting as a robbery, but later confessed it was an accident. Well, with friends like these, who really needs enemies? But to be fair, it was Miguel who wanted to test out the vest, proving once again that the tree of life is often self-pruning.
I have come for you. I am death.
The first clue for police that 51-year-old Craig Wistar of Warren, Ohio, shouldn't have been driving was that he was behind the wheel of a car facing east in a westbound lane at around 2 a.m. on December the 4th. The second was the 50-year-old woman in the back seat who mouthed, "Help me," to officers as they questioned Wistar, who had a bottle of vodka at his feet. When asked what he was doing, Wistar replied, "I'm Ubering." Officers moved the passenger to their patrol car, then administered a field sobriety test on Wistar, during which he admitted, "I'm plastered. I'm talking hammered. I confess, I'm drunk." The Uber passenger got a ride home from police, and Wister pleaded guilty on January 14th to driving under the influence. Most important, he will no longer be able to drive for ride-sharing apps. Well, I'm glad that he can no longer drive for ride-sharing apps, but I'm curious who made the decision. Is it the law who says he can't, or the ride-sharing apps who say they won't let him drive for them in the future? There's a big difference between the two, you know. Big difference. Meanwhile, another inebriated winner behind the wheel is 48-year-old Sunita Jaram of Lexington, Kentucky. She was arrested for driving under the influence at about 1 a.m. on January 13th. Her explanation to the police is quite special. She said she did it for her son. Sunita told police she had been drinking all day and drunk a bunch of beer and got into her car to drive to teach her son a lesson. Her son, whose age was not reported, told police that he had tried several times to get out of the BMW X1 due to his mother's driving, but the doors were locked. Sunita was also charged with endangering the welfare of a minor. Yeah, not exactly Mom of the Year material, is she? I don't know what lesson she was trying to teach, but I'm sure her son learned a few big ones loud and clear. And you know, he couldn't get out of the car because of child-proof locks. It's unfortunate that the car didn't have drunk-proof locks on the outside. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, three people were arrested on drug charges following an investigation into a man pleasuring himself in a Dover, Delaware Target store dressing room with the door open. According to authorities, officers were dispatched to the Target on both Saturday, January 19th and Thursday, January 24th for reports of a man they identified as 23-year-old Lewis Foreman masturbating in a fitting room while the door was open. In both cases, he fled the store in a gold Jaguar. Police tracked Foreman to an apartment. Foreman arrived in the area, but he fled on foot when officers tried to stop him, entering a residence through a rear door and hiding in the attic with 20-year-old Tyra Mifflin. A 3-year-old child was left in a bedroom during the pair hiding. Both surrendered to police without incident a short time later. A search warrant executed at the same resident turned up 8.75 pounds of marijuana in seal bags, digital scales, packaging materials, and $4,432 in suspected drug proceeds. Also taken into custody was 29-year-old Kiara Johnson, who arrived at the residence while officers were at the scene. Okay, let's go on the assumption that anyone can momentarily lose their mind. That might explain the weird thrill of enjoying the pleasure of your own company in a Target store dressing room. But doing it on two separate occasions? Now, I've been to a Target store. It's not exactly a turn-on. And doing that with the dressing room door open, then escaping both times in a gold Jaguar? Are you just looking for attention? That's not a good trait when you're already leading a life of crime. Just saying. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? A couple of weeks ago, we had Michael Perez do an opening guest slate for the Stuff File program. At the time, I mentioned that Michael was a serial tech entrepreneur, software engineer, mathematician, and radio host, originally from Montreal, now living in Santa Monica, California. He operates a web development and cloud hosting company. He's also working on a web series called Travelpreneurs, Breaking the 9-to-5, which provides a complete guide on how to efficiently travel the world while making money. Now, at the time, I said that perhaps we should have him on the show as a guest to talk about his show, and that time is now. So Michael joins us on the line via Skype from Las Vegas. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Peter. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Thanks for being on the program. So as I mentioned in the intro, and I also mentioned back when you did the opening guest slate, you have what has to be one of the longest business cards in the world. As I mentioned, all the things that you do, let's talk about the web series, because that seems to be the interesting point here. Travelpreneurs Breaking the 9-to-5. Tell us how that got started and who you're speaking to.
Yes. That's perfect. The thing about what I do is that everything is kind of meshed in together. So, one domain of my life ends up trickling down into the other. And starting Travelpreneurs was just an inevitable byproduct of my current lifestyle. So I travel around the U.S. and Canada working, and I meet all sorts of amazing folks on the way. And throughout this process, I've learned kind of like how to hack the system, get the right credit cards, do things correctly, travel effectively, find the cheapest flights, and make sure that my work lifestyle has no geographical constraints. I get to travel freely and work in the cloud. And this kind of lifestyle kind of inspired me to partner with my co-host, Talia Grace. And we've created we're working on right now, a complete 10-step guide. And it's a web series where we interview folks all around the U.S. and we come up with a comprehensive guide from A to Z, how to take control of your entire life. If you're not entirely content with the 9-to-5 or you're looking to make money while traveling, it is a complete guide to doing so. And as a software engineer who's working with a few startups in the cloud, that is precisely what I do.
Now, I'm wondering, since you're doing this web series, you're going around and gathering this information, and it's information that you yourself are using. Was there a trial and error period for you when you were starting to do this and you made some mistakes? In other words, what's the biggest mistake people make in going along the path that you are trailblazing?
Great question. I believe that the biggest mistake folks make is that especially when they're coming out of college or, they're entering the work world, they tend to prioritize incorrectly. And often people's main focus is making money. How do I make money? And when your main focus is making money, you deprioritize what's really important, which are the skill sets in order to make really good money. Money should be an inevitable byproduct of a stellar service. So for me, when I graduated, I did not focus on money. I focused on honing my skills. I focused on starting something that I can call my own. And, at first you might not see the payoff because these models, are a little, they're somewhat exponential in some ways. And, exponential models, when they take off, but it takes a while till you get to that place. So, for me, focusing on doing high quality work, providing quality to my clients, being useful in a unique fashion was my most important decision. And I felt that that's way more important than money. And I feel that people who do enter the industry sometimes focus on money more than offering true value.
Okay, well, let's go back in your journey. As I mentioned, you're a tech entrepreneur, you're a software engineer, you're a mathematician. So let's go back to when you were in school. Mathematics was what you were taking, I would assume?
I started off doing computer sciences.
Okay.
And then I graduated. I did a 9-to-5 job for 2 months, and I was just like, this is not for me. I decided to go straight back to school. And I studied mathematics, and then I graduated, and then the day I finished my last exam, I took a flight to California and fell in love with this place. And then I realized, the pursuit for knowledge should never end. So now I'm actually in school right now studying biomedical online. And, and that's essentially what it's been for me.
So again, when going back let's talk to for the sake of this conversation, let's talk to young people who are in school. Sometimes when you are going to school and you've decided what you want to do or what you want to take, you realize somewhere along the way that maybe your path isn't exactly the one you are currently on. So when did that happen for you?
Oh, I agree 100%. And it's a catch-22. The more you learn, the more you know what you want to do. But if you haven't learned enough, how do you know which path to take? So the way I looked at it is that I never discovered after computer science that I don't love computer science. What I discovered was computer science was a subset of what I truly loved. And what I truly loved was science. And for me, my advice to those who are unsure what they want to do is there's two things you have to recognize. First of all, you got to be confident that things work out because they usually do. Now, if let's just say you're studying psychology and, you're really unsure whether you want to become a psychologist, my advice is, right now you have your semester started, you can cancel your courses. Do the best you can at this moment because somehow these skills will become useful eventually. And, And the second piece of advice that I give to folks is that if you're unsure what you want to take, but you have a broad idea, for example, you know you want to study sciences, study something more in the abstract realm, because there's more application and you have more maneuverability. So, for example, if you're unsure if you want to do computer sciences, physics, or, you know, or whatever it is, study something as abstract as mathematics, because it'll hone your skills, your critical thinking skills, and then you can always trickle down and choose a different degree, you know, should you not be content with something like mathematics. And I kind of did the reverse process. You know, I studied computer sciences and then I studied mathematics. But, you know, even though I don't really consider myself as a computer scientist, I consider computer science an extremely effective and powerful tool to express myself in science. So, you know, regardless of whether I want to be an actual programmer on a desk, I think that the skills that I got from computer science were extremely valuable.
So conversely saying that, going back to your days in school at the very beginning, did you ever anticipate that what you'd be doing now is what you're doing now?
No way. If you would have told me in computer science that I would fall in love with biology, I would tell you, you just really don't know me, like, clearly. And the person who you know the least is really yourself. Let me just say this. As a kid in high school, I had ADHD. I just didn't fit within the system whatsoever. And, you know, I was getting private attention in mathematics. I felt a little humiliated every time our math teacher would come in. I'd have to go to the special room and get private attention in mathematics. You know, it was funny how it all played out, because I turned out to be pretty good in math. And these things play out quite interestingly. And I most certainly did not think I'd fall in love with mathematics. I most certainly did not think I'd fall in love with biology. And I most certainly did not think I'd want to spend the rest of my life doing research in human aging.
Okay, so we're leaving out one important aspect, one important component in all of this when one goes through the student life, and that is, regardless of whatever it is you want to do and whether you want to find your own path along the way, there's always the parental pressure. So what did your parents say as you kept making changes in your life and your life plan?
Oh, interesting. So I didn't actually stop what I was doing and move on. I have to mention that I did complete whatever tasks were in front of me. So I did complete computer science. I did move on to mathematics and complete that. So I didn't necessarily pull the plug on it, on anything. And my parents were kind of supportive, to be honest. They didn't really, you know, they knew I like computers and they were proud. They're happy that I went into mathematics. I did feel a little bit of pressure to start working because I've been in school for so many years. But I think eventually when you show that you're passionate about your pursuits and you have a goal and you're determined to hit it and there's positivity around that goal, at least for my parents, you know, they end up understanding that you know what you're doing and they leave you to it. So for the most part, my parents have been quite supportive of what I do. But for those who don't necessarily have those situations, you know, you really have to understand that real progress takes time. And the key to success here is confidence, that you'll eventually look back and it'll all make sense. Because it's very enticing to, you know, go to college, graduate, and then start searching for the best paying job. It almost seems counterintuitive to turn down a $110,000 job at Amazon and then go straight to working peanuts and making $30,000 a year. It doesn't make sense. Why would someone do it? But, you know, when you're focusing on offering true value and you're confident that it'll all make sense, when you look back, you know, it somehow does.
Now, people can find out more information by going to your website, which is michaelperez.com. And Perez is spelled P-E-R-E-S. I also mentioned the show Travelpreneurs, Breaking the 9-to-5. So for the purposes of our discussion, when people go to your website, when people listen to your web series, who is it you're trying to reach the most, and what is it you want to say to them?
Okay. So first of all, I want to mention that michaelperez.com is my official website. It kind of just generalizes what I do. My Travelpreneurs website is pretty much complete, but it's not live yet, so I can't give that out just yet. But, you know, for the kinds of people that I do interview, or we are interviewing, are folks who are, you know, likely entrepreneurs, some folks who are doing sometimes, let's just say we're making a specific episode on getting your credit cards right. We'll speak to a financial specialist or a banker who's been involved in the industry for many years and knows all the cards so we can get specific details. He might not be a travelpreneur, but he does constitute to a specific topic of discussion. But generally, we're looking for folks who have a unique way of working, who've broken the corporate system, who work for themselves and get to travel freely. And we're interested in hearing their story, you know, what they do that's unique and how they can share information with the world.
How can people find the show?
So we have the first three episodes done, but they're not live. They're still in post-edit. So, you know, I will post the link on my site as soon as it is live. The release date is June 1st.
Okay, so people can go to your website and keep looking at it, and they'll find out eventually when the shows are available, correct?
Yes, correct.
Michael, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
No problem. Thank you so much for your time.
Michael Perez from the new web series called Travelpreneurs Breaking the 9-to-5. As you heard him mention, it's not ready for release yet, but you can go to Michael's website at michaelperez.com. And Perez, by the way, is spelled P-E-R-E-S. That's michaelperez.com. And he'll keep you posted as to when the show will make its grand debut. You can also find him on Instagram. His handle is at mike.514. That's at mike.514. on Instagram. And in the meantime, at his site, you can check out all the opportunities he has to offer. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0493, and you'll find the links to Mike's site and also to his Instagram account. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob Dorigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Have you seen a new gas can lately? I'm talking about the kind you use to fill a lawnmower, chainsaw, leaf blower, or any small engine. All gas cans sold in the United States now are missing something that they've had for decades. A vent. That's right. A little vent on the opposite side of the can from the spout has always made it easier to pour gas. But not anymore. And because not having that vent makes it harder to fill a gas tank, it's causing a lot of people to, well, vent about it. A few years ago, the Environmental Protection Agency developed new regulations for gas cans to reduce spillage and eliminate vapors. To conform, gas can manufacturers had to eliminate the vent. Problem is, many consumers think the new cans are so hard to use, they wind up spilling more gas than before. Let's be fair, this isn't the first time a well-meaning government regulation has backfired. If you know of a similar story, tell us about it. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, here he is, a man who is short in stature, but reaching for the top, Stuart Nauman.
Well, thank you, Peter. Thanks for the, the height joke, but which I come to expect after all these years. How many years it's been we've been doing this?
About 30.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Why should I be surprised? But, you know, I did reach for the top, which is true. And in this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at that high school quiz show, but not the history of the show, but just one game in particular, because, you know, if you were a high school student in Canada during the 60s, 70s, and 80s, myself, it was mostly the 70s.
Well, hold on a second. We got to put some very important stuff here. I mean, I know you're talking about a particular game that didn't even take place in this city.
Yeah.
But I think it has to be mentioned right off the top. You were on Reach for the Top not once, but twice.
Yeah, that's right. I was on Reach for the Top for two seasons, in 1978-79 and 79-80, representing Sir Winston Churchill High School in Ville-Saint-Laurent, a suburb of Montreal. And on the second year, our team won the provincial championship and went to the national playoffs.
And not many people get to be on Reach for the Top even once. You were on it twice. So, round of applause Stuart Nauman.
Thank you. And you know, I have most of those games on tape, and I transferred them to DVD recently. So, yeah, I have a visual record of most of those games.
You should put some of those up online.
Well, I would like to. You know what? That's not a bad idea. You know what? I'm going to I'll speak to you about that afterwards, Peter. We'll work something out about that.
Absolutely. So, anyway, to the book at hand, talking about Reach for the Top. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, you know, like I said, if you were more of a straight-A geek than a jock during that time, And then your only extracurricular activity choice to show off all the information and knowledge you have absorbed, both academic and non-academic, was not the track team. It was Reach for the Top. Now, during its 25-year run, its near 25-year run on CBC television, Reach for the Top successfully ran on its continuing mission as an exceptional showcase for Canadian high school students to exhibit their knowledge and power of quick recall on a variety of factually based subjects, whether they learned it in or outside the classroom. Now, between 1961 and 1985, students who participated in Reach, in which they represented their respective high schools in teams of four, shared the same goal: answer as many questions correctly within a half hour of airtime and amass the most amount of points than your opponents. And if you won the required amount of games, you earned the right to compete in the provincial championships in the spring. And then if you won that, you went to the national playoffs during the summer in a chosen host city somewhere in Canada, where the ultimate goal was to win the national Reach for the Top, to win basically national Reach for the Top supremacy. Now, like I said, I was on Reach for the Top almost 40 years ago. But you see, what happened was, and I know what it's like to, you know, to be on a winning team, especially, you know, going national, you know, winning provincially and competing nationally. But what happens when a school's Reach for the Top team won the national title? And because our team finished second in the nationals. And how far were the repercussions felt by that victory, not only in their immediate community in particular, but throughout their province in general? Case in point, the team from Gonzaga High School in St. John's, Newfoundland. Now, during the 1974 Reach for the Top national playoffs, which were coincidentally held on their home turf of St. John's, Gonzaga were seen as underdogs when they made it to the final game against the heavily favored team from Archbishop O'Leary High School in Edmonton, Alberta. So when the buzzer sounded 30 minutes later to end the game, Gonzaga narrowly defeated Archbishop O'Leary by a score of 300-275, thereby giving Newfoundland its first ever Reach for the Top national championship, and setting off a reaction across the province that was almost on the same scale as Paul Henderson's winning goal during the Canada-Russia Summit Series 2 years before that.
Wow.
Now, how could this single victory on the nationally telecasted high school quiz show have so much significance for this young province? Joan Sullivan, a Newfoundland writer and editor, recaptures the spirit and meaning behind Gonzaga's 1974 Reach for the Top national championship win in her fascinating book called Game. The book is an oral history that tells the story behind the single championship game, as Sullivan interviews most of the players from both teams, including veteran CBC broadcaster Tom Harrington, who represented the Gonzaga team, as they give their perspective on their respective schools and how important a role Reach for the Top served there. As well, thanks to a very diligent effort in transcribing the championship game word for word from a video recording that was found on YouTube, Sullivan recreates the game down to every question that was asked by Reach for the Top's eminent national quizmaster, the late great Bill Guest, and what a gentleman he was. I met him, I knew him when I was at the Nationals, and those questions that were answered by both teams. And with behind-the-scenes comments interjected throughout the transcription, this section of the book captures the excitement of the championship game as it was an ESPN 30 on 30 documentary.
Now, besides capturing the moment and the effect it had on the community in the immediate aftermath of winning that championship, does the book delve into in any way, shape, or form how it has affected, if it is at all affected, those who participated later in life?
Well, you know what? Tom Harrington mentioned that, you know, it helped him gain confidence and, you know, when in the ambition he wanted to go into broadcasting. Most of the participants that who were interviewed for the book actually have made names for themselves and went on to very good careers in the field of law, medicine, media. So it really was good to them. You know, and one of the participants from the Newfoundland team who lives in Toronto, and when he occasionally visits, his hometown, people still remember that. And they go up to him and they still remember, when they won the title in 74. So, yeah, it has a far-reaching repercussion for them personally.
Wow. Impressive.
But, it is. But you know what? What I liked about the book also is that Sullivan gives a much broader perspective to why this final game had so much significance. Basically, it fell to the right place at the right time category because in 1974, Newfoundland and Labrador were commemorating their 25th anniversary of being admitted to Confederation with a series of celebrations and special events. So basically, 1974 was a good year to be a Newfoundlander. And thanks to the year-long celebrations, Newfoundland life and culture started to gain exposure across the country, led to the period known as the Newfoundland Renaissance, which included TV shows such as Ryan's Fancy, movies like The Rowdy Man, and a new brand of Canadian comedy thanks to the legendary troupe Kotko. So To sum it all up, Game is the very first book published that singularly focuses on how Reach for the Top was a truly Canadian social and cultural phenomenon to so many teenagers of high school age, especially during its CBC heyday. And thanks to Joan Sullivan and her immensely enjoyable book, we discover how the achievement of the 1974 Gonzaga High School team became a microcosm to how truly significant this question and answer high school quiz show became the generations of young Canadians, myself included.
Excellent. And the book is?
It's called Game by Joan Sullivan. It's published by Breakwater Books, which is based out of St. John's, and it's 1995.
And what other books do you recommend in similar genres, sir?
Well, there's no other books about Reach for the Top, but the late Sandy Stewart, who's the executive producer of the national playoffs, actually put together a book in 1984-85, which was a pictorial history of CBC television called Here's Looking at Us, and he included some rare photos of Reach for the Top in his early days, especially when its genesis in Vancouver in 61, the first Nationals in 66. And I think there's a picture of a young Alex Trebek when he was quizmaster in Toronto in around 1963-64. And for Newfoundland, there's a lot of books about Newfoundland history, but John Crosby, who was a former cabinet minister in Brian Mulroney's government.
Oh, yes.
He wrote a very excellent memoir called No Holds Barred. And if you want to find out how he had to work with Joey Smallwood, the only living father confederation, who basically had an iron grip on the province during its first 20-odd years, of its existence. Great inside account of, the real Joey Smallwood. And it's really, you think there's, boss politics were involved there. That's why, so if you want a bit of a Newfoundland angle, John Crosby's memoir, No Holds Barred, quite interesting book, actually.
Okay, and again, this week's book is?
Game by Joan Sullivan, published by Breakwater Books, and it's 1995.
And how can one reach you at your lofty Reach for the Top manse? Where can they find you?
Well, unfortunately, you won't find me at Studio 42 at the Maison de Radio Canada, where we used to tape Reach for the Top. But you can find me in the pages of the Montreal Times in print or digitally at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Sue.
Well, I'm sorry, Peter. You're welcome. You see, those Reach for the Top glory days still have a hold on me.
Okay. Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program here on a show that is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way, and I've got one more Stuff File news story that I want to share with you in just a moment. But since we were just talking to Stuart about books, I want to mention one more book. Guess which one it is? Yes, boys and girls, it's mine. Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. Inside the pages of the book, you'll find conversations with Oscar winners, Emmy winners, Tony winners. Tony winners like Carol Channing, who just passed away a few weeks ago. I had the pleasure of talking to Carol on more than one occasion, and you'll find those conversations within the pages of Great Conversations. People like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, Christopher Plummer. The list goes on and on and on. So get the book. It's published by Bear Manor Media. You can find it on the Bear Manor Media website at bearmanormedia.com. And, of course, you could also find it on amazon.com and amazon.ca. It's available in the hardcover edition or dead tree version if you want. It's also available in e-form for your Kindle. I love my Kindle. I know many people out there love their Kindles. So you can get it for the Kindle as well. So buy the book. What are you waiting for? Anyway, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? When 43-year-old Terry L. Downs-Hayes didn't show up in court to answer felony weapons and drug charges, warrants were issued for her arrest. The Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania Sheriff's Department got a tip that she was hiding in a house, and people inside refused to open the door, which had been fortified with 2x4 wooden beams. So they forced the door and went in. Now, three people inside gave conflicting accounts of Downs-Hayes' whereabouts, so the deputies searched the home. The search of the residence eventually focused on a rear bedroom closet that was being guarded by two pit bulls. After safely removing the dogs, they found a suitcase in the closet, and when they unzipped it, two hands popped out. Downs Hayes was inside, but surrendered. Investigators are considering charges against the three other people in the home for hindering apprehension of a fugitive. Now, Terry should find accommodations rather spacious when she goes to jail, since she seems quite content to be in the closet, zipped inside a suitcase. You know, she's probably the only person who can fly economy without complaint. It's so cramped up there nowadays. Heck, she might even be comfortable in the overhead bin. Anyway, we're at the end of the program, boys and girls, so you know it's the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I present, the idiot of the day.
To identify the burglary suspect who broke into a closed Florida police substation and ate an officer's chicken dinner, detectives didn't need to lift fingerprints or get DNA from the discarded meal. The ID cards, authorities say, the suspect left behind did the trick. Boynton Beach police said that officers arrived for a morning shift at a department substation and found a broken window and the remains of a hastily eaten chicken dinner scattered in the kitchen. Finding a suspect wasn't hard. They say 29-year-old Yvelande Jean-Pierre left behind her wallet, which contained her two identification cards. Security video shows she spent about 45 minutes in the substation before leaving. Jean-Pierre is charged with burglary. I hope that chicken sandwich was good. Now, why, oh why, would you break into a police station to eat a meal only to leave your ID behind for the cops to easily find? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0493. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0493. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Well, you weren't literally with him. Well, maybe you were, but I don't see how. I mean, he does record these in advance, you know. Okay, maybe you did listen with him. Who am I to call you a liar? And personally, I've never met the guy, and I'm not in a hurry to either.